The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin.
Hello to this very special episode of the Bitcoin & Co. podcast. Why is it so special? It's because of our guest. It's Saifedean Ammous. He's the author of The Bitcoin Standard, a book about the history of money, Austrian economics, and the reasons why Bitcoin is superior to other forms of money tried in the past. Saifedean makes a compelling argument for why Bitcoin is so special. It's not a technical book from a developer's point of view. It's more a book that explains Bitcoin in combination with its economical and technical foundations. As one of his Amazon customers writes in his review, if you ever considered getting into Bitcoin, if you never have heard of Bitcoin, if you are a long-time holder of Bitcoin, this book is for you. Saifedean Ammous is working as an assistant professor of economics at the Adnan Kassar School of Business in Beirut and holds a PhD in sustainable development from Columbia University in New York, USA. In May 2018, he was starting his book tour here in Vienna, Austria. I also attended this legendary meetup organized by Bitcoin Austria, and there is a video of his talk on YouTube. You will find the link to the video in the show notes to this podcast. In his talk, he's telling us about the origins of his interest in Bitcoin, what Austrian economics are and how they are connected with Bitcoin, what sound money and inflation are, why proof of work is so important for Bitcoin, and his vision for money and Bitcoin in the future. Now, let's get right into the 45 minutes of talk with Saifedean Amos about Bitcoin. So, hello. Thank you very much for taking the time to have a chat with me and the listeners of my Bitcoin and Co. podcast. You are the author of The Bitcoin Standard, a book that is highly appreciated in the community of Bitcoiners. You are also an assistant professor of economics at the Adnan Kassar School of Business in Beirut, if that's right. And you hold a PhD in sustainable development from Columbia University in New York. So it seems that you are traveling a lot and living also abroad and studying abroad. But I think you originally come from Beirut. Where are you living and working? And now it seems just you are in the U.S.?
Yeah, no, actually, originally I grew up in Ramallah in the West Bank in Palestine.
Okay.
But I did my undergraduate in Lebanon in Beirut, and then I studied for my PhD in New York, and I went back to Beirut, where I've been working for the past 9 years, teaching economics at the Lebanese American University.
So now it's summer, it's the perfect time for grilling. You said on your Twitter account, I've seen that you like to grill a lot. What's the thing with grilling?
Well, I mean, I've always enjoyed grilling since I was a child, and just keep on getting more interested in it and more involved in it. But the funny thing is that within the Bitcoin community, this is becoming a pretty common thing, and I think it's not entirely a coincidence. It's not only a joke. I think once you break out of the conditioning when it comes to economics and what your university tells you you must believe about economics, it becomes straightforward to break out of the conditioning on other things, particularly nutrition. And it's, you know, just like in economics, they tell us you need to listen to your government and use your government money because government money is the best. They also tell us to listen to their nutrition advice, which has been telling us to eat 6 to 10 ratios of grain per day, and that you should avoid animal fats and that you should avoid animal red meat, and that red meat causes cancer and all of this stupid nonsense that government scientists continue, well, I wouldn't call them scientists, government employees continue to repeat. And in fact, you know, it's almost as, it is probably as liberating and as mind-blowing as Bitcoin once you try doing the exact opposite of everything that your government nutritionists tell you, is stop eating grains and sugars, and instead start eating meat. And specifically within Bitcoiners, you know, there's a growing movement of Bitcoin carnivores who eat only meat and meat only. And I mean, I'm not a doctor and I'm not telling you to do this and try it on my responsibility. You do your own choices. You make your own choices and you bear your own responsibility. But I'm not the only one who has enjoyed greatly improved health when I started eating meat exclusively. And the grilling is the best way to make meat. So amongst Bitcoiners, the popularity of grilling is increasing a lot.
Yeah, funny that you say that, because I'm coming from exactly the opposite way. I'm trying to live vegan as good as I can. I mean, I always, I mix it, you know. But you're right, if you start thinking about what is Bitcoin and not believing in marketing anymore and what people tell you or have all the time told you and take your own look at stuff, I think that's a good general position to be in anyhow. So, and when did your interest in economics start and economics and sustainability? You studied it. So when did that start?
Well, I was doing my undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering, but I took an economics class and became pretty interested in economics and decided that for my master's and my PhD, I would study something related to economics. So I studied a PhD in sustainable development, and that got me interested in economic central planning and economic energy policy. That was the focus of my PhD. Now, during the later stages of the PhD program, as I was beginning to finalize my PhD and try to write it, I just started reading. I tried to start thinking more critically about things, and that led me down the path of discovering Austrian economists whose perspective on how to plan economies and how economic activity happens and how feasible central planning is. They have a very important and unique perspective on this. And so that really drastically altered how I wrote my PhD and how I thought about economics. And after my PhD, I continued to read more about Austrian economists. And that's why, I started understanding their take on money and on the importance of hard money. And that's, from that, I heard about Bitcoin. So I heard about Bitcoin as somebody who's already a believer in the importance of sound money and hard money. And then I heard about this interesting little project of a bunch of computer geeks who have made this digital hard money. I don't even remember when I first heard about Bitcoin, but I was pretty skeptical of it for quite a while because I'm not a programmer, I'm not a cryptographer, and it took me a very long time to be able to understand just how reliable, how unkillable this thing is. And so from the period from 2000, I don't know if I heard about Bitcoin 2009 or 2010, but it was at most 2010. So the period from 2009-10 to about 13, I was still largely skeptical that Bitcoin could work. But it was really after 2013, after it continued to refuse to die, when all of the things that I thought would kill it were happening and yet it continued to survive, that's when I started really paying attention.
Okay. Can you maybe shortly explain what the Austrian School of Economy says and what's the connection there to Bitcoin for people who have no idea about the Austrian School of Economy?
Yes, absolutely. It is my pleasure. The Austrian School is, if you look back to the late 19th century, there were three main economic schools across Europe. So it was the British School, the Austrian School, and the Swedish School. Now, and they were, there wasn't very much, there were differences between them, but, these were the three main schools of thought at that time. Now, after World War One and World War Two, things changed, and effectively only the British school is the one that is taught in American and global universities all over the world. The Austrian school, you could say, it was founded by economist Karl Menger. He wrote a Principles of Economics textbook in 1870, and he was the one who came up with the concept of marginal analysis, which is a hugely important development in economics, not just in Austrian economics, but all economics today is marginal in its analysis. And I think that's probably a little too much to get into now, but your readers can read about it. It's pretty straightforward if they're interested in reading about marginal analysis and its importance. So after that, after Menger, his students, Eugene Bomberg and Ludwig von Mises, where continued to work and produce more research on this. The difference between the Austrian school and what came to be popular across most of the world today, which is effectively British and Keynesian economics, is that the fundamental difference is that Austrian economics starts from the starting point that all value is subjective. Value is subjective, and therefore value is not something that is objective that can be decreed, and it's not something that can just be measured easily, and it's not something that is like a physical property of a good that you can just determine it objectively, In the same way that you can say this pile of cotton weighs 700 kilograms, you can't say that this pile of cotton is worth $700. Value is always subjective. It depends on the person making the valuation. So from this really flows the notion of methodological individualism, the idea that you can't really analyze economics outside of analyzing individual choices and individual actions, because it's the mind of the individual that decides on the value, and it's the mind of the individual that is going to make the trade-offs with any particular economic decision. And it turns out that this was a much better way of doing economic analysis than others. Now, how it is relevant to economics is that once you start from the assumption, from the sound starting point that it's about subjective individual valuation, then you understand that there's no right and wrong in economics. There's only decisions people want to make, and people make the decisions that are best for them. And therefore, we see that in economic systems in which people are able to freely decide what they want to do, people prosper, people do better, and the markets adjust in order to coordinate people's activities with one another in a good way. And so you see, and you know, the Austrian school is associated with libertarianism or with classical liberalism, because it arises from understanding economics, it arrives at the importance of free exchange, at the importance of individuals being able to decide between themselves freely what it is that they want to do and how they want to carry it out. And so based on that, Austrian economists have always opposed all forms of central planning and government control on the economy. And, you know, Ludwig von Mises spent a lot of time fighting that in Austria between the two world wars. And he had a pretty important impact in preventing Austria from becoming a socialist country at that period. But not for very long, as you, I'm sure you know. But then, now with applying it to money, the importance of this is that the Austrians believe that money is something that should emerge on the free market. Sound money is money whose choice of whose value is determined through people buying and selling things through one another freely, whereas unsound money or bad money is money whose value is determined through government coercion. So, like with everything else, Austrians go back to the issue of individual freedom, and with money, it's no exception. And this is really what sets the Austrians apart. So all the stuff that I mentioned earlier about subjectivism might not sound all that important for you and your readers, but really what really matters is the issue of money. Austrians believe a free market is capable of providing a modern economy with money simply by people choosing the money that they want, and its value emerges on its own. Keynesian economists, statist economists, government economists, central bank economists all think that without the government there to provide us with money, you know, bad things would happen or we wouldn't be able to have money.
Mm.
So this is how it's relevant to Bitcoin, in my opinion.
Yeah. Do you have any example for a country or an economy that works like that?
Well, I mean, it's not really straightforward to say a country that works like that or doesn't work like that. Every country works like that in the sense of the rules of economics and the laws of economics still apply to you, whether you choose it or not. So, you know, countries where they try to centrally plan the economies and then they end up with mass unemployment and maybe even starvation are an excellent example of a validation of what the Austrian economists say. But, you know, if you want to see an example of a free market economy, I think the best examples in the 20th century, you'd see, I think, Switzerland is probably the best example. Switzerland continued to be on the gold standard until, you could say, the 30s, you could even say the 70s. And even until the 90s, they had a very strong cover of gold behind their currency. Switzerland has very little role for government in its economy. The people just do what they want. And, you know, there's a lot of economic freedom. And as I'm sure you know, Switzerland is not exactly doing too badly from this kind of economic system.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so it's and I think the monetary freedom aspect of it is highly underestimated. Switzerland, and as I show this in my book, up until the 1970s, Switzerland had practically no unemployment. You look at the unemployment rate in Switzerland under the gold standard, it was almost always zero, between 0 and 0.2, 0.3%, something like that. Only after they moved away from the gold standard in the 1970s and started following Keynesian monetary policy of expansionary monetary policy, did you start seeing the regular increase in unemployment. Only then did unemployment go up over 1%. And since the 1990s, when they sold the majority of their gold stock, unemployment has gone up to 3%, 4%, and 5%, and now Switzerland's economy is similar to any other industrial economy, where people think that unemployment and business cycles and recessions and inflation are just a normal God-given thing, you know, just like we have storms and lightning and rain and clouds and the weather changing, we also have inflation and unemployment. And that's not true. That is absolutely not true. And Switzerland is the best example of that.
So in your book, you often refer to Bitcoin as digital gold, when I understand that right. And I think many people have the misconception of the worth of gold, that it's made, that the worth is because people like to wear it as jewelry. But yeah. Can you explain what really makes the worth of gold and where is the connection to Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, there are many other things that also get worn as jewelry, but they are not money. Silver, diamonds. Precious stones, they are all used as jewelry and they all look pretty, but they're not exactly money. And the reason for that is that, in my opinion, what matters about gold is its monetary characteristics. And this is a problem that many gold bugs or people who like gold, you know, they get too fixated on the physical properties of it, which are really interesting from a chemical and aesthetic perspective, but they are not what make it money. What makes it money is the fact that it's its economic properties. In particular, is the fact that what I call the stock-to-flow ratio for gold is extremely high. It's the highest ratio amongst any other commodity or metal that we have ever invented. And that specifically refers to the hardness of money. In other words, I describe this in detail in my book, anything that people are free to choose anything they want as money. But the problem is that if they choose something that is easy to produce, then others will produce more and more of it, which will increase the supply, which will bring the price down. Therefore, your choice of money ends up costing you because you stored your wealth in something, the value of that thing went up, but then when others produce more of it, they are able to decrease the value of the things that you have simply by producing things outside. So therefore, anybody who ends up using something that is easy to produce as money will just witness their wealth disappear. On the other hand, people who produce things that are hard to, who use things that are hard to produce as money, will instead find them easier to keep their wealth, will find it easier to keep their wealth in it. If it's hard to make things, then it becomes easy for you to store your wealth in it. And so gold was the hardest metal that we had ever invented in terms of its production. It's very rare in Earth. It's very hard to find. It's very expensive to mine. And no matter how much we find, even if we spend a lot more resources on digging for gold, it's very hard to increase the supply in any meaningful way because the fact is that gold does not ruin. So we've been accumulating gold for thousands of years, and any new amount of gold that we add to it through production today is not really going to make a huge difference on to the global stockpile of gold that exists, right? Because we've been piling up gold production for thousands of years and nothing has been lost from that gold. Whereas with all other metals, the current stockpile is just the production of the last few years. All the old production has corroded or rusted or been destroyed in one way or the other. So as a result of this, gold ends up with what I call the highest stock-to-flow ratio. In other words, the stockpile that exists today is highest compared to the flow or the new supply that is being produced this year. So or another way of looking at it is that it's the inverse of the annual supply growth rate. So the annual supply growth rate for gold is almost always around 1.5%, or as far back as anybody can remember, it's between 1 and 2%. Every year, we're adding 1 and 2% to the global stockpile of gold, and that is why gold is money. That's why, because it's hard for people to be able to make more gold in response to increased demand, and so gold is the bubble that cannot pop, because you cannot increase its supply much more. And that's the economic property of gold that Bitcoin copies. Bitcoin has none of the physical properties of gold, but it does have this monetary property. The supply starts off growing at a very quick rate for the first 5-6 years, then it begins to decline. Now currently we're growing at around 4% per year, But in a couple of years, we're going to drop our growth rate below that of gold, so that each year the Bitcoin supply will increase at around less than 1%, and then it's going to tend towards zero. So that's, I think, why Bitcoin is very interesting for me as a monetary instrument.
And also because of the fixed supply.
Yes, yeah. And that's the other aspect of it, which is that Bitcoin, not only does the supply decline, but also not only does the supply growth rate decline, but also it declines all the way to zero, and so the supply is constant. And so we get to a point where the quantity of Bitcoin is going to be fixed at 21 million. Mm-hmm. And that is the first time that we have a liquid asset that is divisible, that is combinable, that you can send and receive easily, but also is strictly limited in its quantity. And I think this makes it an excellent store of value, because it's impossible for people to make more of it, to devalue the value that you store into it. That's really an astonishing new aspect about Bitcoin, which I think is possibly the most important economic characteristic of Bitcoin. It's truly unique.
Yeah, I think in general the concept is a genius concept, because it's a combination of so many things. It's not only economic, it's also technology and mathematics and cryptography and also game theory, which is also used to reward the miners for mining the Bitcoin blockchain. And I think that's great, because they are incentivized to be positive and fair towards the Bitcoin blockchain. What else is so important to use the proof of work concept for mining? What do you mean?
Well, I think that the proof of work concept, anybody who thinks that proof of work is wasteful, or who thinks
that's the thing I wanted to follow up then.
Anybody who thinks, you know, we could just fix Bitcoin if we just found a way to make proof of work cheaper or more economically more economical or less energy intensive, I think that misses the entire point. If there was a cheap way to make Bitcoin and to make the proof of work, then the Bitcoin security would fall apart. Similarly, if there was a cheap way to find gold, if let's say we get hit by an asteroid that is full of gold and that contains, say, 20 times the amount of gold that exists on Earth, and that's actually quite possible, because apparently the entire quantity of gold that has been mined in all of human history would fit into two Olympic swimming pools or something like that. You could fit it all in gold bars into two Olympic swimming pools. That's it. So if you imagine, you know, that's you could have a meteor that's 100 times the size of that. So if the Earth gets hit by a meteor that just sits there in the middle of a desert somewhere, available for anybody to go and chip out gold from it, gold's monetary role would be destroyed. If gold becomes cheap to produce, and the supply can continue to increase very easily, or if we keep getting hit by these meteors once every year, gold would not be money. And so, you know, the only reason that this system works is that expensive resources have to go into verifying, into writing the blocks. And so in order to ensure that the miners are honest, we have to make sure that they spend money first in order to be able to write the transactions onto the blockchain. And then once we are sure that they've spent that money on solving the proof of work and that they have the correct transactions, then they get rewarded. It's this asymmetry that ensures that they're honest, because if they try to lie, then they have just wasted all of those resources for nothing. And then it's a very losing proposition. I mean, currently it costs maybe around $80,000 or so to write a block onto the Bitcoin blockchain. So every 10 minutes or so, miners are spending roughly in the range of $80,000 in order to get the reward, which is around $80,000. It might be more, it might be less. It varies with the price and the difficulty, but they vary around each other. So we know that miners need to spend something like $80,000 in order to commit a block to the blockchain, and then they receive the block reward. If you made it so that they don't have to spend the $80,000 in order to get the reward, then it becomes very easy for them to lie. And so this the having to make the cost real is what ensures the system operates without having trust in anybody.
But this doesn't set the price of Bitcoin. I think that's also a misunderstanding often, that people think that the cost of the power and the electricity and the computers, that this money defines the price of Bitcoin. But that's not true.
That is absolutely not true. And the only reason people think like that is because they have not studied Austrian economics enough. Go and read your Austrian economist. You will see that the cost of production follows the value that people give to things. The reason that diamonds are expensive, or the reason that Bitcoin is expensive, is that people value it. Because people are willing to pay $8,000 or $6,000 for a Bitcoin, that's why miners are willing to spend up to $6,000 making a Bitcoin come out every day. So that's what makes the cost of production expensive. It's because people value it. It's not that we spend a lot of resources on it, and therefore that means it's valuable. Because, you know, you could spend $10 million. The favorite example that the Austrian economists give is a mud pie. You know, if you go and you spend your entire day baking a pie made out of mud, just because you spent an entire day behind it doesn't mean that people will pay you the wages that you think you deserve for them. If people value the mud pie, they will pay for it. And then, based on how much they value it and how much they're willing to pay for it, you will dedicate resources in order to produce it for them. And you will be able to dedicate more or less resources for them. So therefore, the value is subjective, as I was saying earlier. Value is always subjective. And the cost of production follows the value. So the reason people are spending a lot of money on making Bitcoin is that people value it that much.
So we always have the criticism in papers, and people tell me also, you know, one transaction is so environmental, so bad for the environment, like driving 900K with a diesel car. You are an academic in the field of sustainability, but nonetheless, you are a Bitcoin fan, a Bitcoiner. And I think compared to other forms of money, or producing money, or producing gold and storing gold, producing Bitcoin is not so wasteful or needs so much electricity. What do you think of this?
Well, I think, you know, again, good economists don't just look at the what is in front of them. They look at what's also unseen. They try to understand the whole picture of what are the costs and the trade-offs involved. So, I don't agree with Bitcoiners who respond to this by saying, you know, look at all the banks in the world and look at how much electricity they consume, and we could replace them all with Bitcoin. Because I don't believe that Bitcoin is going to completely replace the job of banking. I think the job of banking is just a valid business line that has existed throughout human history, regardless of the monetary medium that has been used. And I think it will continue to exist, because people will always want to store their money with others, because they don't want to have all of their wealth hiding under their mattress, so that if one guy comes into their home, they're able to steal everything they've worked for throughout their entire life. The idea of putting secure storage with others is going to always appeal to a lot of people. It may not appeal to many Bitcoiners who are happy to do it, but I think it's going to always appeal to a majority of people. And secondly, you know, the notion of the job of banks in matching borrowers and lenders, and in taking investments from savers and giving them to investors and entrepreneurs, this I think is an enormously important job in a modern capitalist economy, and it will survive. So what we want to think about when we are saying, when we're discussing Bitcoin's energy consumption, is what is the alternative really? What are the alternatives? What is Bitcoin really saving us from with this energy consumption? In my opinion, as I said, it's not the buildings of the Federal Reserve and the central banks. What Bitcoin allows us to do by utilizing electricity for energy consumption is to make monetary policy free of human control, free of political control, completely independent from politicians. And I think, you know, once you understand what the cost of having central banks controlled by governments has been, then there is absolutely no chance that you think any amount of electricity is too much for Bitcoin. You know, the reason that having central banks control the money supply is why we've had wars in the 20th century lasts for so much longer than previous centuries, as I mentioned in my book. Having central banks control it is why today we have Venezuelan hyperinflation. It's why we have Zimbabwe hyperinflation. It's why we have the U.S. government able to launch wars all over the world without having to worry about it. You know, think about, my favorite example is to think about the Iraq war in 2003, when I think it was Paul Wolfowitz or one of these neocons who went in front of the Senate and said, the whole war should cost maybe $1 billion to $2 billion, and it will pay for itself over time. Now, 15 years later, we know that the war has cost somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion, so 1,000 times the amount of money that that liar had said cost. But that is only possible in a system in which money is easy, because in that sort of system, you know, the money, the war starts, and then the government just essentially prints the money that is necessary to finance it. Of course, it's not printing, it's more complicated than that. But, you know, the central bank provides the government with the liquidity that it needs. Citizens are only going to get the bill many years later in terms of inflation and in terms of the recessions and the business cycles that they go through. So imagine if the American government, if the neocons had gone to the American people and told them, we want to bring democracy to Iraq and it's going to cost us $1 to $2 trillion. And we need you to pay up front so that we can arm our soldiers. What would have happened then? Mm-hmm. Almost certainly, I mean, not almost certainly, certainly, there's no chance that Americans would have paid that amount of money out of pocket. This is what hard money allows us to do. It allows us to always have accurate accounting of the costs and benefits, because nobody can cheat the system by printing money. Nobody can just cheat the system, print money, and then finance their operations. Every government, every individual, they have a very clear idea about the costs and the revenues of their actions. And that honesty is very, very valuable. And if we had that, we'd be rid of hyperinflations and all of the terrible damage that they're doing, which you can see in Venezuela today. We'd be rid of a lot of the wars. I'm not saying we would not have wars, but wars will be very, very different. If you read about wars in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, kings were very much more careful about not launching wars that were unnecessary. They were much more careful about not getting into expensive conflicts. Wars were resolved quite quickly because if you started running out of resources, then you got into deep trouble and you could lose your crown.
Mm-hmm. But how do you see the way to this point? You know, because I've lost a lot of trust in society and my people here in Austria, for instance, because they voted for a very right-wing government. But still, there's no uprising. You know, people are still doing their jobs, doing their things. There's a little bit of protest, but nothing really. So how do we get there to this point that people realize how freeing and how potentially, let's say, a good Bitcoin system like Bitcoin could be for us as a whole?
Well, the good thing about Bitcoin is that, I mean, I generally am not a fan of politics in all shape and form. I think Bitcoin, I think politics is just a very, very stupid way to waste your energy. And it's completely counterproductive. Nobody gets what they want. And really, you know, you're an individual in this life, and you will only ever succeed in doing things that concern you as an individual, not if you're trying to control others and have others control you. So I think voting in general and democracy are just completely counterproductive and very destructive ideas. I don't think that you're ever going to get good change out of this. And, you know, this might sound crazy, but if any of your readers is interested in learning more about it, I highly recommend a book by a German economist called Hans Hermann Hoppe. And the book's title is Democracy, the God That Failed. Mm-hmm. And we all grow up thinking of democracy as the nicest thing imaginable. You know, democracy is like apple pie and motherhood. It really isn't. If you think about it critically, if you think about what are the costs and the benefits of democracy, it's not been fun. It has not been a good thing for humanity over the last 100 or so years. And the good thing about Bitcoin is that it does not rely on that. It does not rely on any voting. And Bitcoin is economic reality. The way that I see it, Bitcoin continues to operate successfully, which, you know, it might not, but if it does, if it continues to operate successfully, it will continue to maintain its scarcity and it will continue to clear payments around the world. And I think it's going to impose itself that people will use it not because they agree with its political philosophy, but because they are economically self-interested. People will want to have a store of value that can hold, allow them to hold wealth into the future. And over time, more and more and more are going to realize that Bitcoin is the best for doing that because of its scarcity and its neutrality. And so it's I believe that, you know, economic reality does not mean you and me to impose itself. So similarly, we don't need to be organizing political parties and running elections for Bitcoin. Bitcoin is big enough to take care of itself. And to go back to your original question, you know, the key thing that I try to emphasize in my book, if you read the subtitle of my book, it says the Bitcoin Standard. The subtitle is the decentralized alternative to central banking. Bitcoin is not here to replace banks, as I was saying. Bitcoin is here to replace central banks and central banks' settlement mechanisms amongst themselves and central banks' ability to set monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really think about it that way, each Bitcoin transaction cannot be compared to your MasterCard transaction. Your MasterCard transaction is just a centralized ledger entry with MasterCard. And, you know, you pay me $10, so MasterCard will take $10 from my account to yours, go through my bank and yours, and they all do all of those things. But for every 1 million or 10 million transactions that you carry, that your bank carries out for its customers, at the end of the day or week or month, it will make a settlement payment with another bank that is a final settlement payment, that is money that is going to move irrevocably back, or settlement payments between central banks. This is like the equivalent of moving gold in the gold standard. This is what Bitcoin transactions can be compared to. So currently, it costs, yes, no matter how much energy you, and I've seen many estimates, and I don't think there's, it's very easy to estimate how much energy they consume, but currently, you know, assuming it costs, say, $100 of electricity to send one Bitcoin transaction, it's an extremely exaggerated value. But even if you assume that, well, one Bitcoin transaction can send the equivalent of $1 billion in Bitcoin from the U.S. to Austria or from the U.S. to China, and it will complete the transaction in under 1 hour. What other options do you have for sending $1 billion of value on under 1 hour for $100 worth of electricity? And you see, once you think of it that way, you understand the difference between a consumer payment and a settlement payment. Once you understand that, you realize that actually, even at $1,000 of electricity per transaction, Bitcoin is a massive, massive saving. It's a huge technological breakthrough because it allows us to move value trustlessly across the world. And there are no other alternatives that do that. If you want to move $1 billion in terms of gold, you know, the cost of that is going to be enormous, not even comparable to Bitcoin.
But why are you so sure that this will be Bitcoin and not, for instance, Ripple? I mean, that's what you know, what you read in the papers and, yeah.
Well, Ripple, I mean, that's a very bad example. I mean, it's probably the worst of all of the, it's my least favorite of all the shitcoin. I hope you don't mind me saying shitcoin here. I mean, Ripple, look, Ripple is just a centralized data ledger entry at the offices of some startup. So effectively, we're going to have the entire global monetary system settling through Ripple. Then we have just decided to put this startup made up of a bunch of shady characters who had been part of other shady startups before. You know, one of the founders was part of Mt. Gox. And we all saw how that worked out. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to this group of people and we're telling them, hey, you get to be the kings of all of world finance. And so when the Chinese central bank wants to send $50 billion to the U.S. central bank to settle their trade or whatever, you know, they're going to do it through you and it's going to be done with Ripple. The Ripple are just data entries on their centralized server, and all of their pretenses about being centralized is obviously completely nonsensical. So it's not going to be any of the other coins because they are all centralized. And this is, you know, they all copy Bitcoin's design, or they copy Bitcoin's ritual, or they copy Bitcoin's marketing in order to go around and say, we're also decentralized. And that's really silly. It's because Bitcoin's decentralization is not through its design, which thousands of people have copied. It's through the fact that its design has grown out there in the market on the internet without anybody controlling it, and it continues to be operational and continues to succeed without there being anyone in charge. And I think after 2017 and after all of the drama that we saw with the miners and with the startups trying to fork Bitcoin and failing miserably at it, I think we can conclude quite reasonably that it's nobody really controls Bitcoin. And it's a very tough claim to make, and it takes you years of observing Bitcoin to be able to believe it. So none of the coins, the other coins, can even come close to making this. You know, you name whichever coin you want, and I can pick any, and I can find you the people who control it. You know, there are thousands of these coins out there. If you have heard of any particular one of them, the only reason that you heard about it, unlike Bitcoin, which was truly a unique breakthrough, and you heard about it because it was a new breakthrough, all the others, they didn't offer any unique breakthroughs. All the others are just worthless copycats. And so if you've heard about one versus any of the others, the only reason you heard about it is that it has a team of people behind it, marketing it and promoting it. And they're not marketing it and promoting it for fun, on for charity, or because they want to build a neutral global system. They're marketing and promoting it to make money from it. They're spending money on it so that they would get money back from it. And that's what all shitcoins have done. This is the only thing that shitcoins do, and that is enrich the people who produce them. So, you know, none of them is able to perform one single commercially viable thing that Bitcoin does not perform. After all these years, there is no single altcoin that has done anything that Bitcoin cannot do. The only thing that they do is exactly what Bitcoin does. You know, private key, public key, and then a shared ledger of transactions, and then you get to spend money around. That's it. That's the only thing that they all do. But the other thing that they have is that they have a marketing team behind them, pushing them and trying to get people to buy them and sell them so that they would get rich. It's worked. But, you know, this is why, for me, is that altcoins are so completely uninteresting. They're just, you know, it works like the Madoff Ponzi scheme works. And I don't care about the Madoff Ponzi scheme. I'm not stupid enough to fall for it, and I'm not, you know, and I'm not the sort of person who would like to go and tell stupid, greedy people that, no, you're being stupid and greedy, stop being stupid and greedy, you're going to lose it. I've tried doing that, and I realized that the only thing that happens from that is that you just upset people and aggravate them, and that the only way that people will learn is from their own mistakes. So, you know, all of these altcoins are just silly scams, in my opinion. None of them will ever have what makes Bitcoin important, which is the fact that it is completely decentralized and controlled by nobody.
Yeah, actually, that's the same as like Andreas Antonopoulos said in regarding Ponzi schemes. He said whenever he tried to tell people that this is not okay, he gets the worst, they write him the worst things and say it's not true. And yeah, as long you believe it and the first people in the row get their money out of it and they tell the others, then no, it's working, then actually you can't stop that. That's
yes,
sad.
And people
but
would much rather hear the notion that they can get rich easily than somebody who tells them, no, you have to actually work hard in order to get rich. So it's a thankless task being the person who goes around them, which is why I, you know, the more I think about it, the more I avoid any discussion of altcoins. I mean, on my Twitter, I've now muted the names of all of the most popular altcoins. I'm just absolutely not interested in anything that happens to them. I have absolutely no interest in knowing about it. I have no interest in getting into discussions with the people behind them. And I realize, you know, they want to get into those discussions because the only way that they can have any relevance is to pretend that they are rivals to Bitcoin. And when we as Bitcoiners start talking back to them, to the outsider who doesn't know the difference, it looks like, you know, this is just like you say, Pepsi and Coca-Cola fans fighting with each other. No, Pepsi is better. No, Coca-Cola is better. It isn't like that. Bitcoin is not competing with those things. Bitcoin is completely different from those things. Mm-hmm. Those things compete with Bernie Madoff and other Ponzi schemes on getting people to invest in them. Bitcoin is competing with the dollar and the euro and the IMF standard drawing rights and gold and all these international currencies for the settlement of international payments. This is really, I think, why it's a complete waste of time to even get into discussions of altcoins. People will learn on their own.
So, coming to our last questions now. You mentioned Austrian economics before. Which book would you recommend for new people to read, the first reader on Austrian economics?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say if you wanted a comprehensive textbook where you could just read it and learn all of economics from A to Z, the best is still a book called Man, Economy and State. And it is by Murray Rothbard, who's not Austrian himself, but he was a student of the Austrian economist. He was a student of Mises. This book was relatively recent, and it's written in plain English, so you can just read it and understand it. It's not complicated math, but, because this is what economics should be. So this would be the comprehensive book, but it is pretty long. If you want something that is more of a simple treatment of the same topics, there's an old book called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, which I highly recommend. And it's just small chapters, each one only a few pages long, and it explains some of the main concepts with very simple language and very easy to understand, very intuitive discussion. I really liked that book, and it was one of the first that I read, and it blew my mind. Well, first that I read in terms of Austrian economists. But other than that, in terms of, say, one book that I find really important, I have to pick an actual Austrian, since you're Austrian and we're talking about the Austrian school, and Hazlitt and Rothbard are not. So for an actual Austrian, a brief but very old book by Friedrich Hayek called Monetary Nationalism and International Stability. And this was a book published in the 1930s in which Hayek discusses the birth of what he calls monetary nationalism, the idea that each government now has its own flag and, all of the trappings of nationhood. And you add to that the notion that part of what makes you a nation is that you have your own currency. It sounds almost, for us, the victims of the 20th century, the people who were unfortunately born under this statist system, it sounds like it's normal. Every country that you have your flag, you have your football team, you have your song, and you have your currency with your king or your president's picture on it. And that's not how the world has always existed. And if you look at the turn of the 20th century, this did not exist. The whole world was on the same money, which was gold. All over the world, gold was money. And different currencies were just different weight of gold. And exchanging one currency to the other was as straightforward as exchanging meters to inches or kilograms to pounds. It was just a unit conversion. There was no fluctuation in the exchange rates. Once we move to this current system of monetary nationalism, Hayek shows you how disastrous this has been, how problematic it is. And, he was talking in the 1930s, and you can see the problems unfolding over the next 80 years from that. And I think Bitcoin is an excellent book, is an excellent technology to fix that. Bitcoin really, as Hayek once said, he said something, and I quote that in my book. He says, "Government taking over money, the only way around it is that by some sly or roundabout way, we have to invent something which they cannot stop." And I think that's exactly what Bitcoin is. It's something that's going to take money out of the hands of the government by a sly and roundabout way. People will use Bitcoin because of the economic incentives to use it, and the governments won't be able to stop people from using it. And hopefully, it'll be able to separate government from money for good for the 21st century.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, I highly recommend the Bitcoin Standard, of course. Is there also a German version of it, or will there be one?
So far we haven't. The book is published by Wiley, so if any of your readers are interested in getting it published, they would have to get a publisher in Germany or in the German country that would buy the German rights from Wiley. So far, we've got translation rights for Spanish, Vietnamese, Chinese, and Russian. Those are the four languages that have bought the rights for the book, but not for German. I'd absolutely love it if somebody would translate it. And So yeah, hopefully one of your readers can would have a publishing house or know somebody has a publishing house. Tell them I would love it if it was made into a German edition, and then that would give me another reason to go and visit beautiful Vienna again.
Yeah, that was great, you visiting here, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so my last question, you're promoting your book now over the summer, I guess. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do next, and how can my listeners follow you and support your work?
Well, for the rest of the summer, I'm going to have a few more talks in Calgary and in Montreal and in Dallas. Possible few other cities are being lined up. So you can see all of my book tour events. And then I think in the fall, I'm going to be back in Europe. I'll make a few visits. I'll be in Madrid in October. And I have a few bunch of other dates tentatively arranged. So you can see my tour dates on my blog, which is thesafehouse.wordpress, the safe, S-A-I-F, and then house.wordpress. Mm-hmm. Mainly the best place to communicate with me is on my Twitter, which I spend a lot of time on, or you can also join my mailing list. All of these, you can find them on my website, which is saifeddin.com. So just my first name, saifeddin.com. Yeah.
Thank you for taking the time. All the best to you. And I hope we will meet again, maybe in next year or somewhere or in Austria. And yeah, thanks for being here and have a good day.
Thank you so much for having me, Anita. This was a very fun conversation. And I like that we spoke a lot about the Austrian economy. Look forward to sharing this with my followers.
That's great. Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Bye. Thank you.
Bye.